We are going to move forward, and I'm going to step into a topic that you are all well aware of, more educated at this stage of life than you were when you were a young boy. Some of you are less educated than others, but you'll understand what I'm saying when we roll into this. But we're going to, I'm going to skip the review, and we're going to just talk a little bit about what I've titled here, Jesus School of Discipleship. And he, we're going to draw from the Gospel of Luke, and I want to just lay out kind of the big stage, and then we're going to kind of keep getting in closer and closer until we zero in on one person. And again, just for a reminder, this series, No Little People, is my attempt to present people that are underknown, unknown, understudied, underappreciated. But my big thing, and if you're around me more than 30 seconds, you'll get this, is the fact that God has a plan for the fullness of time to unite all things in heaven and things on earth in Christ. It's a narrative from the beginning of Genesis to the end of Revelation. It's one story of the grand plan of God that we've been drawn into by grace. And so every person in it's important. And we lose track of that because we live in a graded culture, particularly during the time of the Olympics. You know, we lose track of the fact that the person that finished fourth on some of this stuff is a hundredth of a second off, and they're not even on the platform. But we don't think in terms of something beyond bronze. God doesn't work that way. God's the star. Everyone else, and I want you to get this, everyone else in Scripture is the supporting cast holding up Yeshua, holding up Jesus. Everyone. And so they're all important. Just as you are. Okay, so in the Gospel of Luke, starting around chapter 6, there's what I'm going to call the bookends of this chunk we're going to look at. We're going to look at a chunk that's about 7 chapters long, and we're going to zero it down to about 4 verses, and we're going to zero that down to one person. But the bookends on this start out in chapter 6. Jesus spends a night in prayer. And after he spends a night in prayer, he picks a dozen men whom he names apostoloi, or apostles. And this is really important in the story of God because Jesus makes these guys, that they make the transition from being disciples, the Greek word mathetes, a follower, a student, an apprentice, to apostle, which is a sent one, a messenger. And so in a very real sense, Jesus calls out of this crowd that's been following him around for a long time, prays all night. He comes down at the beginning of chapter 6, around verse 12 in there, and he makes this announcement. And he calls these men, 12 of them, he calls them and names them apostles. That's at the beginning of one bookend, all right? The other bookend, and we're going to look at what's in between the bookends, the other bookend is in chapter 9. And after spending time training, all right, those that he named, he sends them out to be what they're called. What do I mean by that? This is the beginning of chapter 9, verse 1. It says that he sent them out to preach, listen to this, to preach the kingdom and to heal. He calls them and names them sent ones. He spends chapters 7 and 8 that we're going to look at training them. Then in 9, he sends them out by themselves to be what they were called in the first place, what they were named in the first place. He sends them out to be apostles. All right? But in between there, is that what we're going to call the course, and then we're going to zero down to one little subject that he deals with one little person. And so in between there, chapter 7 and 8, there's the training of the 12. Now, this goes on throughout all the gospel, but there's this concentrated thing that takes place in here. First of all, Jesus ministers to 4 people with acute suffering. What's acute suffering? What's acute mean? Acute means something that's very intense, but it's very short. Okay? There's acute diseases, and they're bad, but they come and they go. And in this case, he deals with 3 men and 1 woman. He deals with a centurion that's got a sick servant. He deals with a puzzled prophet named John the Baptizer. That's what we call him. His name was just John. He's in prison and he's a little bit confused at the end of his ministry, and he sends a message to Jesus and he says, "Hey, are you the real deal? Or should I be looking for someone else?" As if he had options, right? But he's puzzled. But he's in a crisis. He's in a crisis. Don't get me wrong. This is a guy that's poured his life into preparing the way, being a voice of one crying in the wilderness for a guy that came, and he doesn't quite seem to be what John was expecting. But that was Jesus' MO. Jesus wasn't anything that anyone was expecting. That's why a lot of people got it wrong. A guy named Jairus, who's a ruler of a synagogue, we're going to talk a little bit about him in a minute. He's got a chronic problem, or acute problem, a problem that's very intense, it's crushing him, but it can be fixed really fast. And then there's another one that he ministers to. There's a widow in this little town of Nain, and she's got an only son. So there's a widow with an only son. I mean, you're a widow, you're in trouble in ancient Near Eastern culture. You got a son that dies, you're hosed. You have very few options, if any. And Jesus raises her son from the dead. All right, so those are the four people with acute suffering. Then he also deals with four people with chronic suffering. I mean, suffering that's ongoing, deep, complicated, messy. One of them's a prostitute, a woman that comes into a Pharisee's house from the street. The Greek construction there is inescapable. She's a woman of the street. She comes in and she weeps at his feet. She dries, uses her tears to wash his feet, and then wipes his feet with her hair. Letting your hair down in public in Jewish culture was absolutely scandalous. And then she puts some ointment on his feet. But this is a woman who had been living in a life of a prostitute. No young Jewish girl wakes up one morning and says, I think I'd like to be a hooker when I get older. That doesn't happen. You fall into this, you get squeezed into this through circumstances, but a long life of pain, of being in bed with men that she does not love and who do not care for her and have no intention of anything beyond the evening or the day. He also ministers to a woman named Mary Magdalene. She just enters the script of this story, beloved, in Luke chapter 8. Jesus had driven out 7 demons. Now, I don't think any of us, I know none of us, I mean, I don't need to say a thing, none of us in this room have any idea what this woman's life was like. The mental torment of demon possession, knowing that something's wrong with you, having no control over certain things. 7 demons cast out of her. And it's really significant to me, the next person he deals with, all right, the second one is 3 women and a man, the next person he deals with, right in the story, is the crazy demoniac living in a graveyard that's running around naked, and they can't chain him, they can't hold him, can't do anything. And Jesus casts it. This is the guy that's got the legion of demons that go into the pigs. Now, I don't know if you have ever thought about this, but it haunts me. Because we read these people like they're VeggieTales or something. We don't think of them as real people with real families and real histories that Jesus enters. But picture this woman, Mary Magdalene, who is one of the most faithful followers in Jesus' life. Jesus appears to her before he appears to the disciples. Picture her having been demon-possessed with 7 demons. Jesus delivers her from that. The very next thing we have in the story is Jesus' boat pulling up on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, and they're met by a demon-possessed man. What's going through? You talk about PTSD. What's going through her mind? Seeing what she could have been, seeing what she would have been. Chronic suffering. And then there's a story of a woman that has a flow of blood for 12 years. And spoiler alert, that's who we're going to study this morning. So you may not have come to men's breakfast thinking we're going to study about menstruation, but that's the plan. And it's a topic that you may not have ever dreamt that you would know something about, but if you're married and you have daughters, you become not a scholar, but you know quite a bit. And everything that goes with it, PMS and all those good things, and menopause, and it's a hot mess that Eve got our wives and our daughters into. Okay, what happens while he's training them? He does a number of things that I think are important. He shatters, literally shatters, their theology of separation with his theology of incarnation, skenao, setting up a tent, moving into town, opening up business. he categorically goes through in their presence with them everything that they believe they should not do as kosher Jews. The centurion was a Gentile. He was a Roman. Jesus heals his servant from a distance, but he's still involved with a Gentile. He goes through the second level or first level of uncleanliness, which is called corpse uncleanliness. He touches a funeral buyer and stops it. He has a prostitute touch him. He touches a dead girl, and he's touched by a woman who's ceremonially unclean. His disciples, his apostles, are taking notes on all this. I mean, they're not the sharpest knives in the drawer until they get the Holy Spirit, but they're paying attention. And he shatters this. And we know from John 4, he sat down and had a cup of water with a Samaritan woman who had seven husbands. He's continually, just when they think they got it, he takes them a step further. And they think, oh, I don't know. And then he takes them another step and another step. And so they're getting this exposure to something about ministry. And that's that Jesus illustrates and embodies genuine ministry as what? As the restoration of shalom. What is shalom? It's the Hebrew word, not for peace. Don't go there. The word shalom is things flourishing as they're supposed to be. That's what shalom is. This is important. Look up here. That's what was lost in the garden. It wasn't two naked people getting kicked out of the pool and Jesus gets us back in the pool. That's our view of salvation. What happened in that garden was a loss of shalom. Everything got turned sideways. Man's relationship with himself, his relationship with his wife, his relationship with God, his relationship with all the animals he had just named. I mean, it went from a walk-in deli to Jurassic Park. I mean, it wasn't, well, they wanted to get back in the garden. I don't think the angel was put there necessarily to keep them from getting back into the garden for theological reasons as much as to save his butt. They'd have gotten killed going back in there. And when you and I want to know what is ministry, ministry is what God is doing. What does God want to do in the world? God wants to restore shalom. And Jesus, the apostles, are walking around watching this guy, touching lives that are acutely and chronically affected by what the loss of shalom looks like. Demon possession, poverty, death, disease. And when he sends them out, you can look at this yourself, when he sends them out, he sends them out to proclaim the kingdom and to heal. Restore shalom and announce that the king has come. And the king has come to restore shalom. Let's take a look at a case study here. We're going to zip in a little bit closer here. And I'm going to read this. This takes 2 minutes. When Jesus returned, this is coming back from the legion guy on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. When Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter who was 12 years of age, and she was dying. As Jesus went, the people pressed around him. The Greek word there means absolutely to squeeze, all right? And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years. And though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. Mark tells us that she actually got worse. She came up behind him, touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowd surround you and they're pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceived that power had gone out from me." And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, Mark tells us that Jesus looked at her. When the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in shalom." Peace. While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter's dead. Do not trouble the master anymore." But Jesus, on hearing this, said, "Do not fear. Only believe, and she will be well." And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter, James, and John, and the father and mother of the child. And they all were weeping. They were all mourning for her. And he said, "Do not weep. She's not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. He took the girl by the hand and he said, "Child, arise." Her spirit returned and she got up at once. All right, that's the story that we're going to look at. And again, I think I'm going to suggest to you that we've got another set of bookends. This story opens and closes with Jairus. He's the man with a name. We got his name, right? His name's Jairus. But we also have, I put name in quotes, because he was the ruler of the synagogue. He was the archon, is the Greek word, for the synagogue. What does that mean? He was the COO of the synagogue. He decided who read scripture, he decided who preached on the Sabbath, and he decided who got to pray during worship services. He was the executive pastor of this synagogue. He's a somebody, and he was well known. So he's at the front of the crowd. That's what we get from this story. He's at the front of the crowd, and he boldly comes to Jesus. Now you say, well, he fell on his face. He did, but he went to him. He comes to Jesus. He's at the front of this crowd. There's this huge crowd waiting for Jesus. You know, and I, well, there's a whole series of teachings in that, but I am constantly amazed that Jesus, about the time I would be wanting to get home, pour a glass of red wine, and take my shoes off, Jesus gets hit by another crowd. I mean, it's just every single time in his life, every single time. I think that's why he got up early and went off and had a quiet time. And then even that, Peter came and interrupted that. He was good at that. Peter was good at shooting from the lip. All right, this guy's need is acute, it's public, and it's simple. It's simple. You say raising someone from the dead is simple. I didn't say it was easy. But it's simple, you know? Outside the tomb of Lazarus, what does Jesus do? You know, he doesn't go, hi, hi, hi. I mean, he just goes, Lazarus, come out. And someone said, one preacher said, you know, he had to say Lazarus or the whole place would have emptied, you know? So he calls him by name and he comes out. He says to this little girl, arise. That's all he does. It's simple. And it's public. Everybody knew about it. This guy had a name. People who have a name, when they suffer, lots of people know about it. You know, I have been privileged because of the nature of what I do to have been well-loved and well-cared for the last 18 months because of what my grandson's going through. And this may shock some of you because we don't think about this, but there are people in your life that will spend their entire life, they will go through their entire life, and no one will ever tell them they've praying for them. Ever. There was a church that set up a prayer tent on a street corner in New York and just had people just said, we'll pray for you. And people stopped. This guy was well cared for. He was in a crisis. It was acute. It came and it went. His 12-year-old daughter was dying. That's basically his crisis. And is it a crisis? Yeah. When you face the death of a child, you know, that's a crisis. Theoden in the Lord of the Rings, when he made that statement, no father should ever have to bury his son. That's a strong and true statement. So this man, I don't want to minimize his suffering, but I'm just saying that everyone knew about it, and it was a fast fix. It wasn't an easy fix. It took God in a body to do it. But then you've also got this other person. You got a woman with no name. We don't get her name. She's just a woman. A woman. She's going to become the woman, though, in this story. Literally, that word gets put in front of her name. She's different. She's hiding in a crowd, and she secretly touches Jesus. She's hiding in the crowd. This crowd that's pressing, this huge mass of humanity and sweat that's squeezing Jesus once he gets out of this boat, and Jairus is kneeling in front of him. This woman's buried in there someplace, but she's close enough to reach up and touch, and more than likely Jesus had four tassels hanging over a kind of a square thing that he wore over his shoulder. She probably touched one of those. Because the story had circulated, and this is back in Matthew's gospel, that some people had been healed by touching him. Her needs are different, man. Her needs are chronic, her needs are hidden, and they're complex. 12 years. And I think it's significant. I'm not going to build a church doctrine out of this, but I think it's significant because of the way I look at the Bible and how I think how God gave it to us. The number 12 shows up in here twice, and I think that's important. It actually shows up three times earlier with the 12 apostles. About the time this little girl was born, this woman's dilemma started. What was her dilemma? Her dilemma was that she had and I'm painting a picture here based on what I know about science, she had her period. And the scriptures in the book of Leviticus, chapter 15, had a ton of stuff about what happened to a woman during her monthly menstrual cycle. Everything she sat on was unclean. Everything she wore was unclean. Everyone she touched was unclean. She was forbidden from having sexual relations with her husband until 7 days after the bleeding stopped. She couldn't prepare food. She couldn't eat at the same table as her family. She couldn't touch her children. Couldn't touch her husband. Husband couldn't touch her. She couldn't touch food in the market. So this woman has her period, and she's expecting it to be over in about 5 days. And the 5 days turn into 10 days, and the 10 days turn into 20 days, and then 30 days, and then 2 months, and then 6 months, and then a year, and then 2 years, and then, I mean, do you see this? This is a woman that cannot go to temple, cannot go in the court of the women, cannot go to synagogue, has to eat alone. She has leprosy that no one can even see. She can't touch anyone, she can't be touched, she lives in total isolation. She's anemic. Her mental processing is affected. Her mental health, there is no way on God's green earth that this woman's not depressed. And the Talmud, the Jewish kind of, there's a book that they have that's got a bunch of Jewish commentary on scriptures and stuff. They have an entire section called Nida on menstruation and menstruating women. And there's at least 11 different cures for it. Some of it's ointments, tonics, all this sort of stuff. Crazy stuff like carrying the ashes of an ostrich egg in a linen cloth. Or a piece of barley that you found in the dung of a white female donkey. You think, that's stupid. You know, I promise you she did all that. This woman did everything. And she threw everything to the wind, and she's in this crowd. I just want you to get an idea of what the loss, listen to me, what the loss of shalom looks like in the lives of some people. It's not just invite Jesus into your heart and then, you know, things get better. This woman, her situation was a whole lot different than Jairus's. And I think, and I could be wrong here, but I think that the main reason Luke put this the way he did, he is masterful the way he arranged his gospel, was that Jairus is the context for this real teaching here. Because uncleanness and leprosy are never healed in the scriptures. They're cleansed. Jesus healed people of diseases, he healed them of demon possession, but he cleansed them of leprosy, and he cleansed this woman. And beloved, these are the things that are the closest metaphors we have for sin. This is what God does for us, just in terms of our sin. This 12-year-old curse had consumed this woman. Okay, the restoration of shalom. This is the course. This is what the apostles are getting from Jesus. First thing he does is he restores the physical shalom to the body that Adam's sin had cursed. This goes back to the fall. First thing Jesus does is he heals her body. And she's familiar enough with what this feels like that she knows that she's been healed. You know, and I got Jill's permission to talk to you about this. She's a private person, so that says something. Jill had a hysterectomy when she was 35 because of this kind of thing. She couldn't go out in public just for fear of what was going to happen. And so there's this constant awareness of what's leaving your body, and this woman knew when it had stopped, just like that. So that's the first thing. And this, I'm going to go back to this because this is a big deal to God, and it's a big deal, I think, should be a big deal to us, all right? Jesus restored the shalom of honor and respect that her culture had removed. He calls this woman out, not to make a fool of her. He calls this woman out to restore her. Beloved, this is the only person in all of the Gospels that Jesus addresses as daughter. Doesn't do this anywhere else with any other person. Doesn't do it with Mary Magdalene. Doesn't do it with the little girl of Jairus's daughter. He doesn't do it with her. Jesus exalts this woman, restores her to a place of honor, all right? He also obviously restored her to a place of shalom in all of her relationships. She could touch her children if she had them. She could touch her grandchildren if she had them. She could be intimate with her husband, assuming she had one. I'm assuming all this stuff because in this culture, it would be absolutely unusual for her not to. Unless all this started when she was 12, and she's only 24, but it doesn't read that way. And the big thing here, this is interesting, Jesus recognized her faith wrapped in the rags of desperation. This is huge. This woman was absolutely desperate, had no other options. Jesus recognizes her faith wrapped in these rags of desperation. And beloved, sometimes we are deceived in our own mind by not realizing the same thing. Sometimes our desperation, and this room's big enough for a number of you to have been desperate for something at some point, that can actually be an expression of faith. Jesus saw it, and he says, "Daughter, your faith has saved you. Go in shalom. Live in shalom. Be in shalom." All right? And Jesus pronounced her whole. He didn't just heal her. When he says, "Your faith has saved you," the verb there is sozo. It's the verb we use for salvation, but it's also a verb for wholeness. And it's in a tense in the Greek that means, you know what? You're there and you're not leaving. It's in the perfect tense. It's like you are here and the effects of this are going to carry you into the future. All right? All right, so there's some things that we can learn from this hemorrhaging woman. There's some lessons that we can learn. Number one, there's always hemorrhaging people in our crowd. You know, my daughters are both nurses, and they have told me repeatedly, they said, "Daddy, everybody's got a story. Everyone's got a story. You just get close to them." You know, I suffered with migraines for years and years and years. Used to take shots. At Briarwood, I used to go in the men's restroom and go in the stall and shoot up with Imitrex and then go back in and face a room of ninth graders who were deeply concerned about my mental health. And so I'm sensitive to that. And one day I was at Sam's checking out, and there was this checkout person that was just rude. Just rude. I said, it's been a tough day. And she looked at me. She said, "Nah." I got a migraine. I talked to her, identified with it. Said, "I am so sorry." I said, "There's nothing more frustrating because you're not oozing, you're not swelling. No one even knows." I said, "You can't see, you can't read, you can't perfume, and putting gas in your car sends you to the ER." I said, "I know all that stuff." I said, "I am so sorry." I said, "I'm going to pray for you." And the next time I went into Sam's, I was from here to the wall away, and she saw me, and she waved. You know? That's not a big thing, but it's a thing. But there are people hemorrhaging in your crowd, and they're hiding. Second, authentic ministry removes. Listen to me here before you fill this in. Authentic ministry removes the causes of suffering, not merely the effects. It removes the causes of the loss of shalom. It restores shalom. It doesn't just fix the results of shalom being gone. It works with broken systems. It does what needs to be done to deal with the cause. And some people's lives, if you've ever gotten involved with people, particularly people who have less means than you do, and you get real involved, all right? There's a number of people in this room that we've talked about this. It goes sideways and messy so fast and goes deep so fast you can't believe it. Pretty soon you're involved with their grandkids and you didn't sign up for that, but that's where you end up because it's systemic, it's big. And we can learn this from this woman. Third thing, and I want you to get, Adam made all of us desperate, regardless of what we think or others see. I love you, and I have to tell you, this is a room of desperate men. And if you don't see yourself as desperate, you'll have a hard time ever really trusting Jesus. There was a doctor in this city, Jim Collier. Some of you probably knew Jim. He spoke at Briarwood one day in a wheelchair in his last week of his life before he died of cancer. And he said, "You know, you don't realize that Jesus is all you need until Jesus is all you have." And he said that to a group of high school students. And they all knew he was in the exit ramp. And that's true. Beloved, we are desperate. Regardless of our bank account, regardless of how many buildings we own, regardless of how many books we've written, regardless of how big or small our business or church is, we are desperate. And the day we lose track of the fact of how much we need God, we're in a bad place. And our greatest battles are always internal, always, and private, not external and obvious. The people sitting around you, the people you work with, the people on either side of your homes, the people on either side of your condos or wherever you live, the things that they struggle with are not the obvious stuff. Obvious stuff is fairly easy to deal with. And we learn this from this woman, the contrast with Jairus. All right, some couple questions for us, and then we'll call it quits for the day, all right? Question, honestly, do you believe that desperation is a requirement for genuine trust in God? Now, here's the important thing. I already told you what the correct answer to that is. But the correct answer to this question is not yes. The correct answer to this question is whatever's true for you. This is a real question, just asking ourselves, do I believe that desperation is a requirement for genuine trust in God? And I'd be lying and a hypocrite if I didn't tell you that I don't believe this. A good chunk of the time, I don't. You know, the late Francis Schaeffer said something, and this is going to sound, you're going to say, well, that's stupid. But listen to this. Late Francis Schaeffer said, if the Holy Spirit was taken out of your life for one day, would people notice a difference? Now, the immediate Christian response, you know, is, well, of course they'd notice a difference. That's not true in my life all the time. You know, I've done this for about 40 years. And I can get up and go into automatic pilot and let my personality and humor and all that sort of stuff carry you, and you can be entertained and you can walk out of here and say, man, that guy's good, and there could be nothing of God in the midst of it. And God is faithful to show me that when I get in the car and just say, how'd it go? How'd it go? I've been out here the whole time. I'll catch it on YouTube, I suppose, or something. I mean, I don't know. But it's true. This is a big one. Second question. What's your crowd? And who might be hiding in it? You know, I taught at Briarwood. I taught there 11 years. I had a little phrase I used for myself called shadow people. And shadow people at Briarwood were the kids that floated through the system and no one ever noticed. They weren't superstars in athletics. They weren't on the math and physics team. They weren't cheerleaders and line guard and... I mean, they just move through the system. And I prayed. I just prayed, God, let me find the shadow people. Let me find the shadow people. And tried to spend time with them. A little cutesy, those little clementine oranges one day. I was walking down the hall, and there was a girl sitting on the floor. And I said, have you ever had one of these? She said, no, what is it? And I said, what it called, cuties? I just said, it's a little thing. You know, it's a hobbit orange or something. I don't know what it is. You know, so I threw it to her, and I said, see if you enjoy that. She graduated a couple years later, and before she left the school, she came and talked to me. She said, that was one of the most significant days in high school for me. She said, just that you noticed me, that you sat down on the floor, and I thought, oh, God, help me. Third thing, am I committed to restoring shalom, not merely fixing the effects caused by its absence? I have to camp on this last one, beloved, because this is what God's doing in the world. And I'm going to tell you this without apology and without hesitation. The reason you're a Christian, the reason God drew you into this story is for this third one. You know, Ron's joke at the front was cute. It was one of his better jokes, by the way, Ron. That was good.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'd give you a 6 on that one. All right, so. But you know what? God didn't draw you into the story so you can go to heaven when you die. That's where Christians go, but that's not what Christians do. This is what Christians do. This is what God's all about. God brought you into the story so you could become agents of the shalomic restoration. You can bring the kingdom to small places. All right, let me close in prayer.